Welcome to Truth for Health Foundation press conference on medical freedom. Stop the medical tyranny. I'm Dr. Belit, President and CEO of Truth for Health Foundation, a public charity serving the public good. One of the most unconscionable violations of human rights by an American hospital involves Veronica Wolsky, a well-known Chicago freedom advocate. Her heartbreaking story will be shared in the press conference today by those involved in advocating for Veronica. Once hospitalized in Resurrection Hospital in Chicago, she was administered treatments she had refused. She was denied basic proper medical care she requested and her advocates requested that potentially could have been life-saving. She was not allowed to leave the hospital when she and her attorneys demanded release. Veronica died alone as essentially a medical prisoner when she was denied release to home hospice and denied access to her power of attorney for healthcare matters when her advocate was removed by hospital security. Today, we have courageous whistleblower doctors, nurses, attorneys, patient advocates, journalists, and parents who expose egregious abuses and neglect of patients in hospitals across the country as they are treating COVID patients. Shocking medical tyranny stories that we present will show how hospitals are becoming the equivalent of medical jails for COVID patients, where their rights are violated and life-saving care is denied. Today in America, prisoners in America's jails have more visitation rights than do COVID patients in America's hospitals. Let's listen to the story of Veronica Wolsky.
Well, Americans are witnessing the unthinkable in our hospitals and our healthcare systems around the country as patients seem to be held hostage by doctors driven by a political machine rather than the upholding of an oath. Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vliet, MD, is president and CEO of the public charity Truth for Health Foundation, which can be found at truthforhealth.org, and an independent practicing physician actively treating COVID patients and providing educational programs for patients, community health groups, and health professionals. Dr. Vliet was assisting in the efforts to save the life of Veronica Wolsky in Chicago, who passed away without ever being provided the treatment she or her advocates were requesting. And Dr. Vliet joins us now. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Stu. I'm honored to be able to help in getting the horror out to the public of what happened to Veronica Wolsky in Resurrection Hospital in Chicago last weekend. Our team was requested by the attorneys to be involved beginning on Wednesday afternoon. On Thursday afternoon, we had a medical care team with critical care ICU doctor, independent critical care nurses, nurses on the ground willing to coordinate her medical care in the setting, delivery capability for high flow oxygen, IV fluids, medications, everything she was being denied in the hospital, our team had ready by Friday. And at every turn, I was personally involved in helping the patient's power of attorney. Our team was involved, and our attorneys were also involved trying to help the patient's power of attorney, whom you'll meet later, who was a warrior for Veronica, help her get the patient released from the prison of this hospital, which it had become. Veronica, I heard, I was conferenced in on a conversation that took place. I heard it. Veronica was asking to be released today, and she was denied. She was pressured into intubation. She refused it. I heard her myself. And she asked for the treatment that her power of attorney was fighting heroically. I heard the doctors deny it. Every single step that the patient requested, that the power of attorney requested, was violated in her legal rights to request treatment. She was denied release, even though the power of attorney made it clear she was being released home to hospice. And the patient knew that she might die at home. She asked to die in freedom, not as a prisoner. And quite frankly, I heard the doctor browbeating the patient's power of attorney on Sunday afternoon, saying, well, we can't get hospice here, and that's not our process, and that's not what we do. And I happen to know medically for a fact that what she was telling the power of attorney was not factually correct. Therefore, in my opinion, medically, they willfully denied treatment to this patient. And then the power of attorney learned that afternoon, when she finally got into the hospital to see her, that standing outside her door, that they had taken away the IV fluids. And medically, we all know that if you deprive a patient of IV fluids who's already dehydrated, which her laboratory data showed, then they're going to go down quickly. No matter how high flow the oxygen is, you can't deliver it if there's inadequate fluid volume in the bloodstream. And they had not treated a rising white count bacterial pneumonia. I mean, the oversight and the negligence medically was staggering. I have never in my career seen anything as egregious as what our team, our whole team, was witness to from Thursday through Sunday in this situation. And ironically, we were also brought in on other hospital situations in other states in the same time frame. The same talking points were being used with the patients, the same denial of the patient's power of attorney access to the patient. In fact, at one hospital in Arizona, the patient's power of attorney was escorted out of the hospital in handcuffs. This medical tyranny has got to stop, and Truth for Health Foundation is fighting that battle. We have a medical censorship defense fund to help doctors like Dr. McCullough and others who've been sued for speaking out. We will defend patients and their families and their rights to have their power of attorney request honored. And we know our team was guiding the resources on the ground in Illinois to set up an entire mobile unit to take care of this patient. And she was denied leaving the hospital under bogus descriptions from the team there.
This is horrific what you're describing. And I'm sorry, but with TV and radio, I've got hard breaks that I'm coming up against right now. Truthforhealth.org is your website. I encourage everybody to go visit that. Dr. Vliet, thank you so much for being here. I got to go. We really appreciate you coming forward, and I hope to have you back soon. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you. And now I would like to introduce Nancy Ross, who is the healthcare power of attorney for Veronica Wolski, the American hero freedom fighter who actually died tragically in Chicago's Resurrection Hospital when she was denied the care that the patient requested and that Nancy Ross fought valiantly to implement on behalf of her duties as a healthcare power of attorney agent for Veronica. We were involved as the foundation team of physicians and nurses and resources. We were asked by the attorneys representing Veronica, and we initially met with the attorneys and her power of attorney. And Nancy will share with you the story of her fight to save her friend's life.
Thank you, Dr. Bleep. Thank you so much, and thank you to everyone who is tuning in and is part of this this conference, this news that needs to be shared worldwide. It is my privilege to speak for Veronica and on behalf of the team that worked so valiantly to try to save her life. I'm really still trying to process those 23 days she spent in the ICU begging to get out. She was denied treatments. She was denied even the basic standard of care in the ICU, we do believe, and a doctor admitted to us. She was denied a transfer to the hospital of her choice. She was denied even hospice care. They said she asked every day to leave, and they told her it was too risky, she was too weak. She was denied advocates, her husband, who was banned from seeing her in the hospital, and myself, who was escorted out multiple times by security after I was invited in the beginning, and then they shut me out. I couldn't understand what was happening. I met Veronica in Chicago through mutual friends, and I admired how she fought for justice and for truth and for freedom every day as she stood on that bridge with her banners overlooking the Kennedy Expressway in Chicago. And for 5 years, she was out there almost every day calling attention to truth. And we became good friends. And August 17th, I got a text message from her that she was running a fever. She had started the ivermectin protocol. 5 days later, she was in the hospital. She had recently tested positive for COVID and she had shortness of breath. She was in the emergency room. I began receiving frantic texts from her and was told almost immediately she received remdesivir. She told me she did not want that medication. It says on her hospital chart, she refused it multiple times. I don't know what happened. We knew that that could potentially be deadly for her. We were hoping she would receive the FLCCC protocols, something even as simple, we thought, as IV vitamins. That was denied. I reached out to family and friends. I found out they were hitting many brick walls at the hospital. There were a lot of questions. I jumped on a plane. I came to Chicago and I contacted General Flynn. General Michael Flynn and his family are dear friends of Veronica. He calls her a patriot of the highest order. And he put me in touch with attorney Tom Renz, who then connected me with Dr. Vliet and the Truth for Health Foundation. I signed a confidentiality agreement with them to represent my interests as her medical power of attorney and to have access to Veronica's charts so they could help me understand what was going on. Why was she not receiving these treatments she was begging for? She had ivermectin at home that a doctor had prescribed her, and the hospital, I'm told, refused to allow that prescription in the hospital. Her husband couldn't bring it from home. So I reached out to Dr. Vliet, and then Tracy Beans, another journalist, and her team of nurses came to my aid, and we had an incredible team trying to figure out, to strategize how to get her private care out of the hospital to get her life-saving treatments that she believed she that could help her tremendously and that she believed she had the right to try. The frantic texts included, get me oxygen, get me out, get me medical transport. The torture is real. They are harassing me, she told me. They want to intubate me. And we told her, resist, resist, and she did. She had it in her chart. She did not want to be intubated. She was not eating. When I arrived at the ICU, she had been there almost 11 days, and I could tell her nutrition was extremely poor. At 6 o'clock that day, I talked to the nurse and realized she'd never touched her tuna sandwich. She hadn't eaten all day. We begged for a feeding tube to go in her, and eventually it did, and that did make a difference for a short time. But when they told me there was no ivermectin allowed, no nebulized budesonide, no IV vitamins, we appealed and appealed up the chain through the hospital. The infectious disease doctor who was overseeing her care wrote a prescription for ivermectin. I apologize, he put an order in for it. And that was hours later overruled by the AMITA hospital system. We called for an ethics conference. We were not allowed to participate in that conference, and they stood by the AMITA system and they refused the doctor's order. I called him at home. He was kind enough to give me his cell phone number. I texted with him. He said his hands were tied, either transfer or go to court. So thus we began the process. And it was a horrific ordeal that next week. We hired a lawyer to represent me as power of attorney and issued a demand letter to the hospital, 17 demands. Again, some of it including just basic nutrition to get her strong and to get her off the extremely high levels of oxygen that she was on. We, in the meantime, found a medical transport, an ambulance that could meet her oxygen needs. We were assembling a team with Dr. Vliet to treat her with the medication she needed on the outside of the hospital. We reached out to General Michael Flynn, Lynn Wood, anyone who had a voice who could help us. Hundreds of people called the hospital. They flooded their lines. They said, what is happening? Save her life. Why can't she get the treatment she needs? These are FDA approved drugs. They're just not part of the hospital's protocol, is my understanding, for COVID-19, but they're used in the hospital. Why couldn't she try them, especially when she knew that she was struggling to breathe and she was not moving in bed? She was not getting assistance for therapy because they told her that was too dangerous. So she wanted to try something to get her out. By the final weekend, when we were preparing her care, we even went to the police for help, and we hit a dead end there as well. We spoke with her doctor and Veronica that afternoon on the phone, and they told us we would have to talk to hospice on Monday morning. I said she may not make it till Monday. At that moment, it was like divine intervention. We received a call 15 minutes early from Sister Dee Dee Byrne, who prayed with Veronica, and she told her to not lose hope, that Christ was with her, Jesus was watching over. He would take care of her, and we would get her out just as soon as we could. And she said, today, today. We hung up, and I realized hospital visiting hours would be over. And I thought, I'll try one more time to go up to see if I can see her. There was no security at the door. I went up, I went on the floor, I went up to her nurse, and I handed her our final list of demands to please even give her IV fluids, IV steroids, something. And she was laying so peacefully, and I noticed she had no IV fluids. And the red lights were going off on her machines, her oxygen was dropping. And they said the doctor was too busy to talk. I left, I called the police, I waited. They called apparently and said there was a disturbance at the hospital. I never understood that, and never understood what policy I had violated at the hospital. We felt she had been in isolation at that point over 20 days. She needed family and friends around her. She needed people at her side, and that was not allowed. My final request to the chief medical officer that night was to just let her die in freedom. Let her come into the ambulance surrounded by friends, by doctors or nurses who could try to administer care. And even that was denied. He said she wouldn't even make it to the elevator. So we received a call after midnight at 12:44 a.m. that she had passed away. And, you know, I think every day on the bridge, Veronica told me she would say the St. Michael prayer, ask God for his protection, and she would sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And sometimes she would sing it out loud with people on the bridge with her, often to herself. Sometimes she recorded it. But his truth is marching on, she always told me. And Veronica's truth is marching on. We're so grateful. Dr. Vliet has proposed, and I've agreed as her legal advocate, that we will very gladly have Veronica's memory honored by the mobile COVID care teams, the Veronica Wolski mobile COVID care teams, to provide life-saving treatment that Veronica was denied because of hospital abuse. And I so urgently hope that people, we receive calls now, text messages, emails every day, people in the same situation who are trapped in the hospitals without proper treatment. And we hope, and I'm so grateful, Dr. Vliet, to you all, that we can get this care to people immediately. Thank you.
Nancy, that was such an absolutely tragic situation. To be involved with you and our team over that weekend really shook us to our core as medical professionals, seeing the abuses that you were enduring and that Veronica was enduring, and looking at all the ways that her rights as a patient violated even the hospital's published patient rights statement she signed and was part of her admission records. Truth for Health Foundation is fighting medical tyranny and medical censorship on all fronts. We are fighting to save people's lives, and our efforts had already been underway to develop the mobile COVID care teams that could assist local patients with locally licensed vendors, health professionals, home health agencies, oxygen suppliers, IV nurses, respiratory therapists, and coordinate a plan, organized approach to getting patients and their families the support they needed. And following Dr. McCullough's incredibly effective integrated approach with a multi-drug sequenced approach to the treatment of COVID, including people who are seriously ill. We've all treated them. We all know that these patients can survive if they're given all of the things you ask for Veronica. And we are honored under Truth for Health Foundation as a public charity to carry her fight for medical freedom now forward under the banner of our faith-based organization as a public charity advocating for the public good with the Veronica Wolski Mobile COVID Care Teams. And you will be involved with us, with all of our doctors and nurses and business advisors and attorneys. Our whole team is solidly behind this, and we want to see her fight for freedom honored and her memory live on. Thank you. It is my honor to introduce Thomas Renz of the Renz Law Firm, who has been a tireless warrior for medical freedom and pushing back against medical tyranny on all fronts throughout the pandemic. He is the tireless warrior who is also helping families who are working to try and have access to their loved ones in what have become prisons of COVID wards in hospitals. I am shocked at what we are learning about the way that COVID patients are treated in America's hospitals, with restrictions on care, restrictions on access to basic support, including access to their families, their power of attorney, and even their legal representatives as attorneys. What we've been seeing is that America's jails have more visitation rights than COVID patients in America's hospitals. This is unconscionable, and attorney Tom Renz is helping Truth for Health Foundation fight this battle and fighting independently on many fronts as we confront the medical tyranny that is costing lives every day. Tom Renz, thank you for joining us and being such a powerful advocate for medical freedom.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Lee. It's really an amazing thing. And if you want to understand what's happening in the hospitals, you have to start with understanding what's happening more broadly. From the beginning, COVID's been a lie. Okay, this is a disease that we know to be roughly as dangerous as the seasonal flu. The seasonal flu kills lots of people. On a given year, it may kill 100,000. But last year was interesting because according to CDC statistics, there could have been well over 250,000 flu deaths. Why is that, right? Why is that? Well, that's because when you get diagnosed with the flu, your symptoms are identical to that of COVID. So what they do is, instead of calling it the flu and then treating the flu like we historically would have, what they do is they call it COVID because there's a whole bunch more money in it for the hospitals if you call it COVID. So the doctors have been told they have to diagnose anything that could be COVID as COVID, whether it's COVID or not. So the flu has been misdiagnosed hundreds of thousands of times, literally. The flu has caused pneumonia, as it always does if it's untreated. That pneumonia then kills you in many cases if it's untreated. And untreated is the key, right? So they don't want to treat this. They don't want to do anything with this. So you get the flu, and more times than not, that's probably what it is, but they call it all COVID. But regardless, you get the flu, you get the COVID, you go to the hospital, right? Because they won't treat it early. So, you know, you come in, you're gasping, you're coughing, you're feeling horrible. They tell you to go home. Eventually you get sick enough where they say, okay, we'll take you into the ICU, right? Because they wouldn't give you the antibiotics or whatever else they would normally give you to treat the flu so that it doesn't turn into pneumonia. You know, so typically they've got their different protocols, and you know, some of the different meds that they give for the flu, you know, some preventatives to make sure it doesn't turn into bacterial pneumonia, all these different things. They send that to you and you go home, you get better, and that's it. Now you get COVID because there is no flu. They just call everything COVID. You go to the hospital, they send you home. They say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. Just go home. Then you come back, and then they send you home again. You come back again. Finally, you're just so sick that they have to admit you. They admit you and they put you in this ICU. Meanwhile, once you're there, forget it. It's over. You're as likely to come out alive as dead. What we're seeing over and over again, because the NIH has put out protocols that won't consider what else you might have. They don't care if you've got bacterial pneumonia. They don't care if you've got a treatable disease. All they do is they treat you for COVID because you get a 20% reimbursement bonus for anything COVID related, like remdesivir, which is already a hugely profitable thing. And for innovation, for all these different things related to COVID. So the hospitals don't care. They call everything COVID. You go through this process, and if you're lucky, if you just say, yeah, intubate them, put them on remdesivir, they might let you see your family. As soon as you contest it in any way, shape, or form, if you ask them about ivermectin, well, you're going to have to leave, sir or ma'am, because it's contagious, it could kill you. Well, that's nonsense. If it's that dangerous, how are any of these doctors and nurses still alive, right? I mean, they're in there with these people every day, all day. The truth of the matter is the COVID wards all have positive pressure air filtration systems, which make this very, very, which make it a very safe environment. Plus, you know, I mean, the PPE really doesn't do a ton unless you're wearing, you know, very, very specific high-end gear. So, but the real thing, according to the experts, is the air filtration, the airflow within the institution. That makes a huge difference. That's why there's so many stories of nurses that, you know, aren't really wearing all the PPE unless there's someone there to see it. And they're not going home sick and dying, right? So you're in the hospital. They won't let your family come and see you. Well, that sounds a lot like prison to me, right? They not only won't let your family come to see you, but they won't even listen to your power of attorney or to your medical wishes. When you say, I don't want remdesivir and I won't take intubation, do you know what they do? They come in, they stand at the end of your bed and scream at you about the fact that you're going to die. They tell you, you're going to die, you're going to die. I've got hospital after hospital, story after story. And it's not every patient and it's not every hospital. But if that happens once, it's too much. And it's happened many times. I've got instances from tons of different places. It's happening way too often. Is it the norm? I don't know. And neither does anybody else, because once you're in the hospital, no one can see what kind of treatment you're getting because they won't let anybody in. It's absolutely absurd. So while you're in there and they're harassing you, and we have specific instances, I mean, Veronica, in our case, you know, has talked about this with her POA before she passed, God rest her soul. This torture is happening on endlessly on a constant basis in some places, because there's money, right? There's money. Remdesivir causes kidney failure. It was pulled from clinical trials in the past because it was killing too many of the patients who were taking it. It is a dangerous, dangerous drug that is not safe. It's not effective. And the only thing it does is pad the pockets of the people who it's being used for. It is a deadly, dangerous drug and should not be used ever, in my opinion, though I'm not a doctor. Intubation, it's just the wrong approach for people until they're at the end, according to all my doctors. You've got to fight this. But here's the problem. How do you fight it? The hospitals want you in there. They won't let you in. They won't listen to your power of attorney. They won't let you out. It's a horrible situation. It's dangerous. These people are being tortured. By the time you get a hold of an attorney and the attorney can do anything, I hate to tell you, but the patient's dead more times than not, because they're not treating the patient. They're not doing anything. I get call after call. You know, I look at last weekend. Last weekend, I had probably 20 people contact me asking me, please, please save my loved one, save my loved one. Sometimes it's grown children. No young children, because we can't, there's never any young children in the hospital with this. Save my mom, save my dad, save my grandma, begging me for help. And I know in my heart, as I'm listening to their stories and as my heart is breaking, that there's nothing I can do. We're getting cases. We've got, you know, there's cases where, you know, sometimes if you get it early enough, there is time for us to get, something done in the courts. And, you know, it's hit or miss whether or not we win. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult. And it shouldn't be. Isn't it your right to decide how you want to be treated? And then we hear instances where they're forcing it on them. They're giving it to them anyways, and despite the fact that they said no. That is a battery in Ohio. That is a crime. It is absolutely a crime in Ohio, and probably in most other states. Every state that I'm either doing this or have people doing this, there are serious issues with that.
Tom, I think you're referring to remdesivir being given against patients' wishes. They are not able to get ivermectin.
I want everybody on this to hear me. The NIH has ivermectin listed as an investigatory drug for COVID-19. It's listed on their website. It's there. It's right next to remdesivir. They're investigating it. And of course they are, because that's what they give to illegals. That's what they're giving to all sorts of people, just not normal American citizens. This is a war on American citizens, right? Just like these mandates. You know, most of the people that are being mandated are blue collar workers, American working class. Why the war on America? Why the war on our health? Why the war on our freedoms? My body, my choice. I can pick what kind of treatment I want. Within reason, right? It's not my doctor's job to say, you can't have this. We're not asking for, some bizarre thing. We got people asking for a known quantity. India, in Uttar Pradesh, I believe, eradicated COVID-19 using ivermectin. They're suing the World Health Organization for lying about its safety. You have got to fight this. We, the people, have got to stand up. We're suing, we're gonna fight, we're going after these guys, we're gonna go after all of them, we're gonna make them pay. But I keep saying this in my interviews, and I wanna stress it now. I don't wanna watch thousands and thousands of people keep dying while I'm going through the litigation process. You've gotta fight this. You've gotta stand up for your rights. You've gotta stand up for your freedoms. You've gotta fight. Call the police if they're doing something illegal, if there's a crime. You can fire your doctor, and you should. You can fire the attending physician. You can say to the hospital, I want this attending physician fired. I want someone who's going to actually respect our wishes. And they have to do that. But you need to take a stand. You got to take a stand. Don't take the injections. They're dangerous. And, you know, it's your choice, right? It's your choice. How can you be forced into taking a medication you don't want? If you can do that, how is your life any different from being in prison? I mean, in one case, you're told you can't move around. In another, you're told you can move around only if you get a vaccine. This is the definition of coercion. This is absolutely illegal. We're going after them all, but we've got to fight for our loved ones in the hospitals. I am begging and pleading with everyone on this. If you are within reach of a phone, grab it, call your state rep, call your local reps, call whoever you can call. Stand up, take action, join us in our fight, help us in our fight, get active, get organized, get involved. It's going to take a long time through the courts. We're trying, and we'll get there, but we need you to be active, we need you to be involved, and we need you to help us. God bless you all.
Well said. Thank you, Tom Renz. And that is the role of Truth for Health Foundation as the people's foundation and the people's voice. And together, Attorney Renz, other attorneys, volunteer doctors, volunteer nurses, our entire team is working to put together early treatment programs throughout communities and guide local physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs to implement treatment at home with support of existing resources. We do it all the time for other conditions. We can help in this situation. So let's work together, join our crusade of the voiceless, and we will together be loud and roar for medical freedom. Thank you, Attorney Renz. I'd like to introduce Jody Carroll, an independent organizational development consultant in Texas, who had a tragic ordeal trying to save her mother's life, who was a patient at Baylor Scott & White in College Station, Texas. And Jody's story plays out across America as we listen to what she went through with her father trying to save her mother's life. And Jody, thank you for sharing your story with our listeners. And also, we're grateful that you have volunteered with Truth for Health Foundation to be part of our patient advisory council for patient advocacy. Thank you for helping others facing this horrible situation.
Dr. Vliet, thank you so much for having me on the program today. It is an honor to be able to stand in this place of being a voice for my mother, Carolyn Carroll, and represent our family in the ordeal, the tragedy that we've experienced. And we come on the screen today in order to stand in the gap for other families who are experiencing the same thing. Let me just tell you a little bit and add some color to our story. My mother had been experiencing what she was describing as allergy symptoms, and she stayed at home for a few days experiencing those symptoms, but at one point it progressed to a point where she asked my father to take her to the emergency room. And she went to Baylor Scott & White in College Station and tested positive for COVID, at which point they told her that she had waited too long to be treated. They gave her a prescription on a holiday weekend, 4th of July weekend, and told her to go home and to come back should her symptoms worsen. And so she did that dutifully. She went home. By the next morning, unfortunately, her blood oxygen concentration was at 70. And so my father rushed her back to the hospital, at which point she was admitted. From July 5th to August the 1st, my mother's condition declined. And as we began to form relationships with the doctors, the nurses, the medical team to understand the plan of care, we began to understand that they were taking a conservative, what I would call a more of a reactive wait and see approach to treatment rather than what we desired, which was more of a proactive, aggressive approach to treatment. And that was concerning, especially considering the research that we had done on COVID and that it was a treatable disease. And so it was at that point we decided to seek outside consult from even the nation's leading expert on COVID, Dr. Peter McCullough, immediately stepped in to begin to consult with us on my mother's condition. He was able to identify roughly the stage of the disease that she was in and the medical treatment that she required. So as the intermediary, we spoke with nurses, we spoke with doctors to begin to advocate for my mother. For instance, we asked for an increase in aspirin that she was already on from an 81 milligram dosage, which is a baby aspirin essentially, to 325 milligrams. We also asked for an increase in the Lovenox dosage from 20 milligrams up to 80 milligrams, which was appropriate for her weight, according to the formula for that particular medication for her conditions. And We also asked for colchicine. These are anticoagulants, and we knew that we, based on the consultation that we were receiving, that she would be experiencing thrombosis or blood clotting. As her condition progressed, we understood they were putting her on supportive care. I believe that's a euphemism for hospice. And so we escalated our efforts to get the intervention that we required. We began speaking with the chief medical officer at the hospital, asking for these same medications. We were denied. We asked for an ethics consult. We were never able to reach an individual at the hospital that had a title related to ethics. Eventually, we did try the Right to Try 2017 Act, which allows a family who has a family member in a critical life-threatening condition to try experimental medications. The ones that we were asking for were completely FDA approved. We were denied that. Eventually, our hands were tied. We were forced to lobby for a temporary restraining order and a temporary mandatory injunction against the hospital simply to ask for the medications that my mother required. We went to court, and we were unfortunately denied the request for the medications we were asking for. 3 days later, my mother passed away.
And did you take steps to determine the actual cause of death?
Yes. In fact, the autopsy did show that my mother had complications related to failure to properly coagulate her blood, which can only lead us to believe that the medication that we were asking for would have been helpful, if not have saved her life. And so the outside recommendations that we were receiving were appropriate and sound. They simply were not heeded by the medical staff at the hospital.
So the autopsy showed cause of death, inadequate anticoagulation, which was exactly the treatment that you had gone to court to try and obtain. Jody, this is another unconscionable example of the failure of hospitals to carry out the basic fundamental patient right in all of their forms on admission, the patient's right to request treatment, and the patient's family advocates the power of attorney rights to ensure that they get that treatment according to their wishes. I just am so sorry that your family went through this terrible loss and your mother died when she could have been treated, as you pointed out, as your consultants pointed out, with adequate doses of the medicines that we know work. And I just thank you for your courage. I thank you for your willingness to share your story, to help other families know how strongly they're going to have to advocate for their loved ones to keep them from tragically losing their lives in what have become hospital prisons instead of hospital healing centers. Thank you, Jody. And thank you for volunteering to be a patient advocate member of our advisory council. We are grateful that you're using your adversity and your loss and your tragedy to help others.
Thank you so much, Dr. Blee. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce now one of our Truth for Health Foundation members of our legal advisory council, Lauren Martell, who is an independent constitutional and civil rights attorney with a long career in the great state of South Carolina. She is a staunch proponent of patient rights, civil rights, and constitutional rights. Lauren, thank you so much for sharing with our listeners exactly how their patient rights, civil rights, and constitutional rights are being violated in the medical tyranny that we're seeing, in particular, the way that hospitals are just running roughshod over patients' rights once they are in the hospital. Thank you.
Thank you. That is so true. And I was up close and personal in a case, a specific case in South Carolina, which allowed me to learn so much about what is going on in the huge violation of constitutional and civil rights in our local hospitals. And in South Carolina, we have quite a few different hospitals, but I have learned that they are basically beating all to the same step as far as how to treat COVID-19, which is unprecedented, and it interferes directly with the doctor and patient's relationship for informed consent and decisions on right to try medications and how to proceed on treating individuals. We have found that we had a particular client who was a great patriot, an amazing man, who went into a particular hospital in South Carolina and was not really treated with for pneumonia and was not really treated with what you would normally think the protocols would be for somebody who had an underlying bacterial infection. So he proceeded to get worse, was treated with remdesivir, and then proceeded to get even more worse. Ultimately, he was intubated and put on a ventilator, and his family hired me to write letters to the hospital. We thought we were having great success when we were able to move him from one hospital to another. And the beautiful thing about my legal letters, and I submit that even the audience who have a family member who may be in a hospital may want to even try this too, because it's your life and these are your rights. And we specifically named the chairman of the board of trustees of the hospital. We put him on notice. We found out who he was, and we just got really tired of the people who are accountable to this lurking behind cover and not coming out and being accountable for the decisions that are being made that absolutely affects people's literal life decisions. It was a real life or death situation in this case. We pursued it vigorously and we did move hospitals, but the formulary and then the protocol for treating COVID-19 was the same. So we were dealing with lawyers then, and we found a doctor, which is necessary in a right to try, that you get the ability of a doctor to prescribe the medication and then you refused it. We did that. I was so excited. I thought, wow, this is a chance for this man to overcome now COVID against all odds. And we got a hard no at another hospital. They said, we'd love to bring him in, but we're not going to be able to do anything differently than Pelham Hospital or Spartanburg Medical or Bon Secours. They were all the same. So that really got us to thinking, what is going on? Why is politics in the hospital? Why are political agendas being pushed in the hospital? And what is going on with the pharmacy boards and the pharmaceutical influence in our hospitals that, in my opinion, based as an attorney, and we often look to our attorney general in these cases, but in South Carolina, he's been a little slow to the punch. But we look to him for guidance when pharmaceutical companies get out of control, there's a monopoly or an antitrust situation. So what I personally was able to observe was that there was a manipulation of the pharmaceutical market to promote only one set of protocols that almost has an 80% failure rate, meaning if you continue to do this protocol, you're going to have people die. That's what happens. And so when we raise that, we have been met with a lot of resistance, but that just means that we've gotten stronger and we've had a lot more people get involved as much as people are getting more and more educated. I now tell people we're at war and the Leviathan of the administrative state has infiltrated our hospital system. It's infiltrated our education system. And my law firm was working with things early on in COVID when we were trying to decide who was really an essential worker and who wasn't. And I submit to you that every single human being that lives and works in this state and in this great country is essential. And they started dividing people right then. My firm helped people with mask ordinance mandates. We got exceptions for people, which were always built into these policies. What we have to do is dial back and remember that the Constitution is the law of our land. The South Carolina Constitution governs our state. And when you get overburdened with policy and regulation that started to be created by these agencies that are not elected or accountable to the people, it gets out of control. And I submit to you that the people who are making these decisions may not have the full credential to be making these decisions, The head of DHEC is a doctor, but he's not a doctor of certain kinds of medicines. But these people are starting to come in as an authority and circumvent and try to interfere with. As a matter of fact, it's almost a tortious interference with the contractual relationship between the doctor and the patient, or between the doctor and the hospital that he's working with. These doctors that I've talked to have studied a long time, and they work on getting their licensure updated and make sure that everything's appropriate. But you know what their license allows them to do? It allows them to practice medicine. And they're not able to practice medicine. They're not able to save lives. The people, it's just going to be so egregious when we find out the statistics that are going on in these hospitals. And it's across the board. On the other side of it, I have seen so many people who have had the freedom to use other protocols before they get to the hospital and have an enormous amount of success. And so I believe that from a legal perspective, it's important that, you know, lawyers like me continue to educate the public and continue to stand in the gap where we can. I've written quite a few cease and desist letters. I've written letters putting doctors and hospitals on notice that they need to prescribe certain medications or try certain medications. And that's what we have to keep doing. We must push back. It's a house of cards. They're bullying. It's corporate bullying. It's bullying in the higher education with the students at school. They're sending people home arbitrarily and capriciously, you know, quarantining people. It's a chaotic time, and we are not a state of chaos usually. That's not what South Carolina is all about. We really were the ones that set a bar for liberty, and we're behind the eight ball right now. I'll submit to you that our leadership in South Carolina could do a lot better.
Well, thank you for the courage to boldly speak the truth and take a lead where others have failed. That is the role of Truth for Health Foundation. As a public charity, we are the people's foundation. We are volunteers. We are not paid. And those of us on the medical advisory boards, legal and medical and scientific and nursing and clergy, all of us are volunteers for the people. And we are the voice of the people. And we are working to defend your freedom, your right to decide your treatment, and your right to have advocates with you when you are sick. And thank you, Lauren Martell, for being an attorney willing to take up this banner on our crusade for medical freedom. Thank you for being with us today. And we have a lot more to come in the fight for medical freedom. Thank you. It's my privilege to introduce Graham Ledger, the two-time Emmy Award-winning host of The Ledger Report, and a major ally in the fight for freedom, very much aware of what's happening with the issues of medical tyranny. Thank you for being part of our show today and our press conference, Graham. We appreciate your perspective.
Of course. And I want to tell you, I just got out of a meeting with Mike Lindell and General Michael Flynn in the last 24 hours. And the message from these two gentlemen, as well as myself, is very similar. And that is, we need to pick our battles. We need to pick our fights. We need to stick together in this war for the Constitution and the constitutional soul of this republic. And so what you are doing is one avenue that needs to be fought. What General Flynn is doing is another avenue, and what Mike Lindell is doing is another. And I happen to swerve into all of these. And so when we talk about liberty and medical freedom and the right to choose, as the left says, what to do with our bodies when we want, we're in uncharted territory here from what I am seeing. And we are in some very, very dark times in this republic. When you look at the border, which is under assault, and it's under assault because people within this country are allowing it to be under assault. When you look at our culture and our history, under assault. Again, it's an assault from within. And now we have this layer of COVID-19, which was, and will always be politically motivated. This entire fiasco from the very beginning since around March or April of 2020. I have been saying this never has made sense and it never will make sense. And now that we have all of the data, it's even worse. But back then, my gut was telling me, my gut usually points to due north constitutional. And my gut was telling me there was something inherently wrong with the masks and the lockdown and all that. And I resisted and I said no to all that. And I encouraged everybody else to do so. And it turns out we were right. Even though the government is now marching down the so-called vaccination path, we've been right all along about a simple virus that has almost a 99% survival rate, 98.5% survival rate. And so now what we're seeing and what I am seeing is an ungodly, unholy, un-American, unconstitutional response by hospitals in this country. That if you had scripted this and you had presented this to me as a movie idea, I would have said that's fantastic. It never would be believable. It's definitely in the realm of science fiction. That it appears today that the hospitals buckling under the pressure of politics from Washington, D.C., and potentially politics at the state and local levels are caving to these political bureaucrats and allowing Americans to die in their hospitals. And it appears to me that hospitals are at this moment in time not in the business of saving lives, not doing their fiduciary duty, but they're in the business of making money and following and towing the line of exactly what the government tells them to do.
That's exactly right. And one of the things we are seeing from the standpoint of patients' families and legal advocates and power of attorney is that if you look at the policies in America's jails, prisoners have more visitation rights than COVID patients in America's hospitals.
It's unbelievable. I have a friend who I've known now for 20 years. He is an emergency room physician. He contracted COVID. And he's somewhere on the East Coast. I probably shouldn't say exactly where. I don't know if I have his permission to do so, but he's in the Southeast Coast area. He was admitted to the hospital. Now, remember, this is an emergency room physician. And he shared a room with another patient who had COVID-19, who was significantly younger than him, at least 15 years younger. And he, as a physician, was telling the folks at this hospital that he wanted the regimen, including ivermectin and the whole host of regimen that goes with it. And they refused. And so he was in the hospital. I don't think they ever intubated him, but he came very, very close. And we know what happens once you're intubated. It becomes a 50-50 shot that you'll ever survive an intubation or somewhere around there. The bottom line is he almost succumbed to the disease, somehow was able to get out of there after a couple of weeks in the hospital, after the hospital refused his own request, just as an American, but on top of that, as an emergency room physician, refused to treat him in the manner in which he wanted, and they never told him why, just walked away with a smirk on their face, never explained about steroids entering his body, but they won't put the steroids into his lungs, and just ridiculous treatments that made no sense to him. Meantime, his roommate was getting worse. Eventually, he was discharged from the hospital, this physician friend of mine. 2 weeks later, his roommate died of bacterial pneumonia. And this hospital effectively let this patient die of bacterial pneumonia by not treating the patient, by not treating the bacterial pneumonia. And it appeared pretty clear to this physician friend of mine that the hospital, the administration, was following the protocol as laid out by the federal government for a number of reasons. One is liability, but the other is, of course, the reimbursement. And if they pump remdesivir down his throat or into his veins, of course, that's an expensive medical treatment, way more expensive than the horse paste, as the media likes to call it, dewormer horse paste, even though ivermectin has some incredible response to COVID-19 in terms of wiping it out, and an incredible record as a prophylactic. He was refused this. They pumped remdesivir in him. He almost didn't survive. The hospital stuck to this protocol. It almost killed him, but the hospital gets the reimbursement that it desired. And this is a scenario that's not just happening to my physician friend. I'm hearing this story over and over and over again. It doesn't matter if it's a red state. It doesn't matter if it's a blue state. It is all about the hospital administration following the protocol set out by Dr. Fauci and the federal government and not doing what is best for the patient and not doing what the patient requests. It is unbelievable, doctor. It is Soylent Green come alive in 2021.
You're exactly right. Our foundation team was involved in 12 different hospitals in different states over the last 10 days. They were all doing exactly as you described for your physician friend. And this medical tyranny and loss of life has got to stop. Thank you for helping us in the Truth for Health Foundation effort to be the voice of the people and to educate them on their options, one of which is do everything in your power to get early treatment and stay out of the hospital. Thank you, Graham Ledger. I'm honored to have you join us in this fight.
Absolutely. And if people want more information, I put some resources on my website, all kinds of form letters and information about ivermectin, information about the number of miscarriages from young women 20 months or 20 weeks pregnant or fewer that just came out in New England Journal of Medicine. That's not being reported in the media. These are things that had, by the way, an 82% rate of miscarriage. I don't know if you've seen that one yet, doctor, but I'll put it on my website. This kind of stuff is on my website that you will not see in the mainstream media, GrahamLedger.com. We have to stick together. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you. And keep up the fight for freedom. We are your partners in that process. I'm pleased to introduce now a parent who is fighting for the vax against the medical tyranny. Let me start over. I'm pleased to introduce now James, business owner, entrepreneur, and patent holder, who is fighting the vaccine mandates on behalf of his children. James is very concerned about the medical tyranny that is pushing vaccination of children with experimental shots that were never studied in children. Thank you for joining us today, James, in your fight against medical tyranny. And I hope that your words and your drive to protect your children will be an inspiration to our listeners. So tell us your story.
Well, I think like many parents, I find myself in the middle of a lot of pressure to vaccinate my kids. And that pressure is being applied from private schools, from friends and family, and from their family doctors. And the concern I have is that the vaccines are experimental, that they didn't complete stage 3 and stage 4 testing. And I don't wish for my kids to be participating in that experiment, but I understand the concern that's out there for parents. But you would think we were in the midst of a crisis and that this pressure is deserved. And when I did my research, I found that less than 600 children, 18 years of age or younger, have died from COVID-19. That's not a number that is readily available in the media. You have to actually look for that data through the CDC site. In fact, just today, I looked at numbers again, just to see how many 11-year-olds and 14-year-olds, my kids are 11 and 14, have died from COVID-19. And there's only been 11-year-olds in the entire country that have died of COVID-19 and only 20 14-year-olds. So I don't believe the crisis that's being publicized is really there. And as a parent, once you realize that there's really no crisis for your kids based on the facts, based on the numbers, it gives you some space to slow down and take a deep breath and take your time to study this a bit more and understand whether or not it's really a good solution for your kids to take the vaccine. And what I find is that the vaccine is a solution looking for a problem as it pertains to children. When I looked at the viability of the vaccine, I get even more concerned. It's now not something that's effective against the Delta variant. We see that over time it loses potency, you know, within 6 months. And meanwhile, if kids can survive COVID-19, they get natural immunity, and the vaccine would interrupt that process for them. Natural immunity is being shown to combat the various strains, the Delta strain of the COVID-19 virus. And I would hate to interrupt that natural process of their immune system out of some perceived crisis that doesn't exist. And so for me, what I'm trying to do is help other parents benefit from the time and energy and effort that I've put into researching this. You've been a great support. Dr. McCall's research, Dr. Paul Alexander's research is associated with you. I just want to make sure that parents are armed with the information required to make this decision and look at the risk benefits. And lastly, I'll just say, in terms of the vaccine, daily we get more reports of adverse events being publicized on the FDA voluntary adverse events reporting system. And when you look at that data, there's over 700,000 incidents now of adverse events and 14,000 fatalities. I went to Europe to get information to see if I could get even more clear data. And I found a safety data sheet on the Pfizer vaccine specifically that cites 300,000 adverse events and 4,700 deaths on the safety data sheet. And it's the same product being used here in the United States. So I'm very concerned that there's not the risk. The risk is far greater to take the vaccine than to survive COVID. And when I listened to the FDA panel sessions last week, doctor after doctor, scientist after scientist came forward and questioned whether or not it made sense to vaccinate children when there's more adverse events potentially impacting the children with myocarditis, blood clotting, reproductive issues. I mean, these are serious risks. And if less than 600 children are dying of COVID over the past 18 months, I don't understand why we would take that risk with our children's health.
That's a good point. And what is not disclosed to the public is that children who have died of COVID have had very serious comorbidities, serious illness, diabetes, lung disease, other serious autoimmune disorders. There are no deaths that Dr. McCullough or Dr. Alexander have found in the worldwide literature in children who were healthy children otherwise. So the risk of COVID is exaggerated. The risk of the vaccine is underreported and not made clear to the public. And the fact that they are still experimental is also not made clear to the public. Early treatment is suppressed. And for any young person with an existing medical problem, we've just published a joint authored paper from the team associated with Truth for Health Foundation on early treatment options for COVID in high-risk children, which means children with medical illnesses that put them at risk. There's early treatment available. So you're quite right to be concerned. The reproductive damage to the ovaries and testicles of young people is staggering, and they've known that for 10 years. So this is very alarming. I thank you for coming forward. And I thank you for volunteering to be part of the Truth for Health Advisory Council for parents' advocacy and helping other parents have resources to fight for their children as well. Thank you, James. And now I'd like to introduce our coalition partner, honorary chairman of the Tea Party Patriots, Jenny Beth Martin. Jenny Beth is well known to me as a longstanding freedom fighter and a partner in the fight against medical tyranny and the fight for medical freedom. Jenny Beth, thank you for joining our press conference today, and we appreciate your being here to share your statement on behalf of patients and your organization.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Tea Party Patriots has stood for healthcare freedom and the doctor-patient relationship for pretty much our entire existence for the last 12 years since Obamacare was moving through Congress. And over the last 18 months, we have continued to do this. And one of the ways that we've done this is working with you and Dr. Peter McCullough and other doctors around the country, mainly just trying to help get information from them, get their stories out, and make sure that the patients are aware of what doctors who are treating COVID patients on the front lines are saying. And so it's really a pleasure to work and to be a coalition partner with Truth for Health Foundation. One of the very disturbing trends that I have realized over the past 8 weeks or so, maybe a little bit longer, but especially over the last 8 weeks, is that there are patients who are in critical care in hospitals and they are not getting treatment that they request. And I've had requests personally to me from desperate family members asking to be connected with doctors to get second opinions for their loved ones. And all too often what is happening is that the patient does not have the freedom and the liberty to choose who they want to advocate for them. Sometimes hospitals are assigning an advocate for the patient, perhaps even an employee of the hospital rather than the patient's own loved one, and they're not getting the kind of care that perhaps the patient wants. I think it's very important that as Americans, we continue to stand for the doctor-patient relationship, that we don't allow that sacred relationship between the doctor and the patient to be replaced by a government-patient relationship, which may be a one-size-fits-all solution to healthcare rather than personal healthcare based on one's own health history. And I also think it's very important that patients have informed consent and they can make decisions about whether they want to accept medication or decline medication based on that informed consent with discussions and decisions between the patient and the doctor or the patient's advocate or power of attorney and the doctor. And it's very important that all Americans remember we have to continue to protect our doctor-patient relationship because one day we may be the patient in critical care needing our own family member to be able to advocate for us or our own advocate, whoever we may choose. And I just want to make sure that we continue to do that. So at Tea Party Patriots Action, we are working to stop medical mandates, and people can find out more about that by going to stopmedicalmandates.com. And then please just make sure you're paying attention to what Truth for Health Foundation is doing, because they are getting the information out to people around the entire country, and they're doctors and experts who have this very valuable resource available to people. So I just want to make sure people know that this is a good place to go for information.
Thank you so much, Jenny Beth Martin. And to add to what you're saying, when patients are confused about whom to trust, I will say again, all of the physicians and scientists and nurses and lawyers that are on our Truth for Health Foundation team are volunteers. They are risking their licenses, their livelihoods, and their lives to advocate for truth, God's truth, medical truth, and the sanctity of the individual liberty and the individual patient relationship to pursue treatments that are appropriate for the patient and the patient wishes to try. So think about that for all of our listeners. This whole group of strategic coalition partnerships are people who are volunteering to help be the voice of freedom against the tyranny that is assaulting us on all fronts. Jenny Beth, I'm honored to be working with you again as we have intersected over literally since Tea Party Patriots began. In 2009, I proudly wore my Tucson Tea Party t-shirts and stood up for medical freedom then, and we continue the fight today. Thank you for being with us today on this very serious fight against medical tyranny. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now it's my great honor to introduce the Chief Medical Advisor for Truth for Health Foundation, world leader in early treatment of COVID, peer-reviewed evidence-based medical model of successful early outpatient treatment, a dedicated warrior to raise the issues for the public on vaccine risk, on the risk of medical tyranny in hospitals that is following a protocol that doesn't work and has cost lives. And Dr. Peter McCullough is a world-renowned cardiologist, epidemiologist, and clinical specialist academic physician who literally has risked his life, his license, his affiliations, his professorships, and his job to speak truth about medical treatment and risk that are being suppressed. He is a warrior. We are honored to have him as our Chief Medical Advisor for Truth for Health Foundation, and we are committed to be the people's foundation and the people's voice. Dr. McCullough, thank you for being with us today in your tireless fight.
Dr. Bleed, I'm honored to be here and really honored to be the Chief Medical Advisor for the Truth for Health Foundation. America and the world has been waiting for a foundation such as this, an organization that's bringing critical information, but not only that, but providing support and making a real difference in people's lives impacted by COVID-19.
Thank you. And that is truly our commitment. We are a faith-based public charity, and our medical and scientific advisors are all volunteers. So to our audience, when you wonder whom you should trust, think about the fact that we are volunteers advocating for you. We're not the million-dollar, multi-million-dollar talking heads spouting policy. We are your advocates. And Dr. McCullough is one of the most inspiring in my medical career. So tell us, Dr. McCullough, we've heard from the patient advocates. We've heard about the patient's devastating experiences with the hospital interviews. I'd like for you and the hospital abuses, I would like for you to share with the audience the broader picture of how massive the medical tyranny really is that you have experienced and are fighting at every level.
I've been a lifelong employed physician. So unlike other physicians in our circle, I've never been an independent private practice. I always viewed myself as a clinical scholar that I see and examine patients every week, but I also spend a lot of time academically as an editor of two major journals, as a reviewer of hundreds of journals, a contributor. I'm the editor in chief of the first major textbook in my field. And in COVID-19, I've been very involved. I have over 45 publications in the peer-reviewed literature. I've been leading teams around the world trying to exact our efforts and our scholarship towards improving outcomes of COVID-19 through the best we can with research, original research, integrated reviews, and then our key position papers that have culminated in the COVID-19 home treatment guide available through the Truth for Health Foundation.
What about in the outpatient setting, trying to prescribe for patients and trying to get information, educational programs out to the public? Tell us about the tyranny you've encountered there and the censorship.
Early in 2020, there was two things that happened, which were really unusual in medicine. One, there was no encouragement of doctors to do the best they could for COVID-19 patients, none. And we saw nothing from our academic institutions. So for instance, Harvard, Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, Duke, none of them had any early treatment protocols. They had nothing. They offered nothing to patients. It was almost in lockstep with one another. There was no innovation. Can you imagine our iconic institutions not being able to handle a heart attack or a gallbladder or diverticulitis or a skin rash or some other medical condition? Our major academic institutions have protocols for everything. But suddenly for outpatient COVID-19, they had zero. And 18 months later, they still have zero. To my knowledge, they haven't even tried to treat a COVID-19 patient. And that's really unthinkable. And it's hard to imagine if it's driven out of fear or driven out of some other undercurrent. But it was clear what was going to happen is that the medical centers were going to follow the Centers for Disease Control and the U.S. FDA and the National Institutes of Health. That became clear early. And so this meant that those bodies, the CDC, NIH, and FDA, are bodies that serve doctors and they serve patients. They're not considered expert bodies. They're not considered treatment guideline bodies. In fact, the FDA is a regulatory body largely to settle issues of advertising claims on pharmaceutical companies and product safety. The National Institutes of Health is a government research body. They're not a treating body. And then the Centers for Disease Control is really a government body that's meant to handle outbreaks with respect to investigations, but certainly not, they were never positioned to handle the treatment of a major medical problem. And none of those bodies were organized or staffed or equipped to handle a mass casualty situation. But those bodies nevertheless became authoritative, and they developed a tremendous amount of authority, almost by assumption. And then our hospitals and medical groups followed them. So let me give you some important points. One of the first things that they followed was the FDA's one-time statement on hydroxychloroquine. In mid-2020, the FDA made a blanket statement based on very limited inpatient studies and before the advent of any large-scale outpatient trials or randomized trials. And they made the statement that hydroxychloroquine should not be used to treat COVID-19, full stop. They never gave an update. They never reviewed data as they emerge. And now it turns out we have over 250 supportive studies of hydroxychloroquine. The FDA has never revised that statement. More recently, the FDA has made a statement regarding ivermectin, and the American Medical Association has filed ivermectin. It's been said, it was said by actually the division head of the National Allergy and Immunology Branch of the NIH, that there was, quote, no supportive evidence for ivermectin, full stop, without any review, without any understanding or perception of what's going on. We over have 60 supportive studies of ivermectin, 31 randomized trials, just like hydroxychloroquine, huge bedrock of evidence. And so these dismissive statements that are not evidence-based, that are not updated, become these permanent milestones in academic medical centers. And so after each one of these announcements, an email typically went out in the big systems that says, doctors, please be aware, you will not use hydroxychloroquine. You will not use ivermectin. It's stunning the impact of these statements. They permeate down through medical groups, through state medical boards, through pharmacy boards. And then there is a follow through where physicians in medical groups are reprimanded if they attempt to help a patient with hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, as an example. A pharmacist then takes it upon their own initiative to block a prescription to a patient for ivermectin hydroxychloroquine. Now, they may block it outright, or they may do an administrative step like saying, well, I need to call the doctor and clarify. And when they can't get the doctor on the phone, the pharmacist happily tells the poor suffering patient or their family member that they can't dispense the medication. And it goes from there. We have doctor email medical updates. They come through Medscape and through heart.org, et cetera. And they continue to undermine anything we can do to help patients with COVID-19. So one just came through today as an example. Many of the listeners will know that there's been an emerging amount of data on the use of oral and nasal rinses to reduce viral load in the nose and the mouth. And we've been led by Dr. Paul Gossett in Chicago, who I had on America Out Loud, the McCullough Report. Paul's done a wonderful job. He summarized the literature for us, randomized clinical trials, preclinical studies, all highly internally and externally consistent, that there's a variety of viralcidal topical agents now, dilute povidone iodine, dilute hydrogen peroxide, hypochlorite, Scope or Listerine. They all have effects in the nose and mouth to reduce the viral load. Well, today, coming through one of the major doctor emails, a very pejorative title to this story, it says, anti-vaxxers push povidone iodine with no evidence. There was a recent one that came out that said, do not use povidone iodine. Patients will drink it and get iodine toxicity. There's been a whole bunch of these basically false and fraudulent statements. And these have been parroted all the way up to the major media. Most recently with ivermectin, you may have seen an FDA statement, really just an absolutely fraudulent, irresponsible statement that ivermectin is only used as a horse dewormer. Well, this is an adult, fully approved medicine. The medicine itself has won the Nobel Prize. It's frontline treatment in Japan, Mexico, all kinds of first world countries to treat COVID-19. It's basically helped crush the Indian outbreak of the Delta pandemic. And yet division head of the National Allergy and Immunology Branch says there's no evidence for it. The FDA says don't use it. And then major media, CNN, MSNBC, ABC, and others had all kinds of statements out there. They're saying it's horse dewormers, that patients were developing liver toxicity. They were dying, being hospitalized. And then Trial Site News broke the news. They called the National Poison Control Center, and they found that there were no serious cases of ivermectin overdoses. There were no deaths. It was all a completely fraudulent campaign through our government agencies and our major media against ivermectin. So we've seen this now with hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and now even topical approaches such as povidone iodine. It keeps going and going. And in fact, the most recent thing we've heard is a plan to try to limit the use of monoclonal antibodies that are fully FDA EUA approved. So it seems like any treatment that we apply through a variety of sources, doctors, and many doctors are on board with these types of statements. So many doctors will say, absolutely, ivermectin is toxic. Well, since when? We were using it for years for scabies and strongyloides. Many doctors suddenly said hydroxychloroquine was cardiotoxic, was causing arrhythmias. And again, since when? We've been using this our entire careers. I'm in my fourth decade of medicine. Hydroxychloroquine doesn't cause arrhythmias or other problems more serious than what we had always known about. So these drugs didn't change. Their safety profiles didn't change. But somehow something in the minds of doctors, the medical groups, the FDA, the CDC, the NIH, the Infectious Disease Society of America, the American Medical Association, all this turned against the patient receiving early treatment, and strongly brainwashed doctors, I think, against early treatment of COVID-19.
I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, hydroxychloroquine has been one of the world's safest medicines since 1955. And a research pharmacist and I did an analysis on the safety profile of hydroxychloroquine compared to Tylenol, non-steroidal over-the-counter medicine, and proton pump inhibitors, acid reducers. And all of those categories of over-the-counter medicines had far more toxicity than anything in the FDA's entire database for 65 years on hydroxychloroquine. So the data contradicts the lies, and what you have courageously led is a fight for truth and for the public to understand this is an orchestrated attack on your medical freedom, your relationship with your physician, and on your right to choose your treatment, and essentially an assault on life, because the death rate is skyrocketing for lack of treatment.
But many have asked me about the complicity of doctors. Why are doctors not treating COVID-19? You can imagine a doctor who's, let's say, over age 50, who's terribly afraid of COVID-19 personally. And you can imagine how well supported that doctor would feel when every single agency says, don't treat COVID-19. Every single agency says nothing works to treat COVID-19. That doctor can be very confident in the answer that there's no treatment for COVID-19, and therefore he or she doesn't have to risk themselves at all in treating COVID-19. So much about this is actually the personal comfort and risk protection of the doctor themselves. Even if it's just telemedicine, they wouldn't have to personally risk contagion with the virus, but they would worry about malpractice risks or risks of potentially using drugs without full guideline support. And so you can imagine how comfortable doctors feel themselves regarding their personal professional comfort to say that they don't treat COVID-19. What I can't understand as a doctor is how can they sleep at night? And I remember I was on Tucker Carlson. I told Tucker, I said, listen, that's not in my DNA to let my patients get slaughtered by the virus and to have my patients on the phone and they can't breathe. And I'm telling them that I'm going to do nothing for them. I think that's unethical. It's immoral. And I think from a civil legal perspective, I think it's illegal. That's what I would call failure to treat, which is one of the two major reasons why malpractice suits go forward. And honestly, I'm ashamed of fellow physicians who have told patients that there's no treatment for COVID-19. And I'm gratified to hear that so many Americans are getting early treatment. Do you know, in the spring of 2020, there was a massive surge of hydroxychloroquine. That's probably what kept our curves down. Now in 2021, massive surge of ivermectin. That's probably one of the reasons why mortality is down despite the Delta outbreak. So we've had a gratifying surge in early treatment. The word is out. America knows that early treatment is there. And what we really need to do is we need to get more doctors off the sidelines and out of this fear locker that they're in. And unfortunately, the stakes keep getting higher and higher as the agencies double down. And in what I call lockstep with one another, they have really locked arms on this. And in the last month or so, we've had a notice by the Federation of State Medical Boards saying that they were going to threaten doctors' licenses for what's called COVID-19 misinformation. And that is very scary in terms of who decides what's information and misinformation. So as you and I review the literature and make a few points on treatment, we try to cite that. The idea that someone could, without any review or any vetting or any fair balance or with any veracity, declare statements being misinformation or information is alarming, putting our livelihoods on the line in terms of our medical license, which is to a physician or a healthcare provider, is really our basis for that allows us to practice in states. And then again, in lockstep, a few weeks later, we heard from the Board of Medical Specialties. So the American Internal Medicine, the American Board of Family Medicine, as an example, a threat. That said, again, if doctors are viewed or declared by someone, it's unclear who, as disseminating COVID-19 misinformation, again, they can be subject to disciplinary action, probably losing their board certification status, which is an enormous financial burden for physicians. And for physicians like myself, it's an every 10-year commitment. I've taken the American Board of Internal Medicine now 10 times. Four times for each 10-year interval. So I'm in my fourth decade, and I'll be doing the same in cardiology upcoming. I maintain multiple other boards as well. So this is a really dark times for physicians right now. Physicians don't know where to hide. They've been told clearly by all positions, by all bodies with authority, do not treat COVID-19. And they've had chilling statements regarding anything we've tried to do with COVID-19, including monoclonal antibodies, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, all the other drugs we use in sequence. And now most recently, even topical povidone iodine. It's almost anything we do to try to help patients is a strong chill is put on it. And now a backlash of professional reprisal against physicians trying to take care of patients.
That's right. And that's why Truth for Health Foundation is a public charity, has a medical censorship defense fund. And we urge all Americans who wish to support medical freedom and maintain access to a doctor who will treat you, who has the courage and the knowledge to treat you, we join our crusade, support our efforts, because we will fight back against this medical tyranny that is costing patients their lives. And medical censorship doesn't just defend doctors. It also can defend patients who actually have been censored and prevented from getting treatment. So, Dr. McCullough, thank you for being such a warrior on this front. We will continue our fight, and we will not be silent. And if they come after us, we will fight back. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. Truth for Health is probably the best named organization ever, because it is about medical truth. It is about correct medical information. And it's really about heroic doctors and other healthcare providers, patients, and advocates in bringing needed medical care to those in need to prevent two things: hospitalization and death, which occurs in both the vaccinated and unvaccinated. So we need to band together to help America get through this difficult time.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. You are an inspiring leader. Thank you for being with us today. I'd like to introduce Nicole Landers, who is a registered nurse and community certified case manager and legal nurse consultant. Nicole is on our Truth for Health Foundation Nursing Advisory Council. She and Shane Clater are co-chairs of our Early Treatment Nurse Supervised Network to assist patients getting early treatment for COVID-19 and in other situations. She is also now the director of the Truth for Health Foundation, Veronica Wolski, Mobile Early COVID Treatment Team. And Nicole was personally involved with the foundation team after the attorneys requested our assistance and the patient's power of attorney requested our assistance. Nicole was one of the people who spearheaded the work to find the nursing and other resources that Veronica needed in order to support her request to be transferred to a home care setting. Nicole, thank you for your heroic fight for Veronica and what has happened since then in other situations where you personally have been working with the foundation team of medical and nursing advisors to find resources. I'd like you to share with our audience just exactly what has taken place, what your role is, and how we plan to advocate for people's medical freedom and access to care going forward as a public charity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Valit, and I'm excited to be with everyone today. I would have to share that I'm quite alarmed at what I'm seeing spring up across our country with regard to medical tyranny and the limitation of patients' individual rights. Since our meeting on the 26th, yes, we've started to get a lot of contacts. I've had a lot of communication with members across the country of our various communities with their loved ones being medically imprisoned. Our most significant challenge so far was with Veronica. And I'm pleased to say that as soon as Tom Rentz reached out to us, within 72 hours, we had a medical team up. We were able to find equipment to support her at home, professionals within the community willing to come alongside and care for her, and excellent nurse practitioner ready to take over the case. And we were ready to go. It is just heartbreaking to me that what pushed back against us had nothing to do with the patient's choice, but the facility resisting honoring her choice. We could have done so much more for her, and it's just a heartbreaking outcome. I'm very excited that you have blessed me with the opportunity to serve as co-chair of the Veronica Mobile COVID Response Care Team, and I'm looking forward to those efforts. Our hope, as Shane and I work to develop this team, is that we're able to support loved ones and patients across the country as they make their personal choices for how to be cared for, that as we're able to do so, if their acuity affords us and it is safe, that we're able to support them in their individual rights and choices to bring them home for safe and effective care that we know is evidence-based and we know it works. I would add, as our second plan, a supervised nursing network for early treatment. I'm working very hard to form a team of nurses across the country on a voluntary basis that are going to be forming relationships with providers and helping to facilitate those that are reaching out to the foundation for help to direct them to providers who are willing to administer early treatment according to the algorithm and evidence-based treatments. Now we've had a couple of really difficult cases that I have tried to step in and help here in the last couple of weeks. Some are really sad because by the time the foundation gets called, oftentimes these patients have progressed to the ICU and have received remdesivir. And at that point, it's really difficult to even begin to activate a medical team that could bring them out. So what I'd really like to encourage everyone listening today to is if your loved one is exposed, if your loved one becomes sick and positive with COVID-19, the time to act is now. Please do not wait until your loved one or you progress to the hospital. Get in touch with the foundation. Let us reach out and help direct you and support you in your pursuit of early treatment. It's effective. It works. I've personally watched it work. I've watched it work within 72 hours. Most recently for some patients of mine that from within my regular healthcare system, when I worked for them, the hospital refused to give them the early treatment, actually sent them home with nothing. They thought they were sent home to die. Well, that's just not the case. We got them medicated, and within 72 hours, the wife was back up, COVID negative, and was able to return to work. And we see this happening over and over again across the country. Truth for Health Foundation wants to see more and more of that every single day.
Nicole, you inspire us all with your dedication, your longstanding career dedication to your patients, but also, especially now as part of our team, I was so impressed with how quickly you responded. We heard from the attorney on Wednesday. You participated in our team meeting on Thursday, and you had already started Wednesday and Thursday identifying the resources. And by Friday, you had with us, with the physicians that were identifying other resources in Illinois, licensed in Illinois, you had all of the aspects in place to support Veronica's request and her family's request through her power of attorney. So thank you for your heroic fight for her. And as we carry her fight forward, just know that what we all were able to pull together to do that could have helped her, at least give her a chance. She knew that she might not survive, but it would give her a chance to die in freedom at home, yes, if that yes was her wish. And yes, that is profoundly critical. So whatever the outcome is, ultimately the patient should be able to choose their course. And that is what you stand for, what we stand for, and we will carry on Veronica's fight for medical freedom. Thank you for being part. Thank you for your dedication, your courage, and your faith. Thank you. I am pleased to introduce not only Dr. Harpal Mangat, who is on our advisory council and an Oxford and United States trained internal medicine specialist, who has been treating the neurologic complications of Lyme disease, as well as neurologic complications of COVID long haul and COVID vaccine injuries. Dr. Mangat is also an expert in monoclonal antibody infusions. We have just been experiencing increasing medical tyranny from all directions, but in particular, a very egregious one just in the last week has been the current administration stepping in and preventing access, rationing, restricting monoclonal antibody infusion services for certain selected targeted states, Texas, Florida, Idaho, and a number of others. There's clearly a pattern here. This is a federally funded program meant to benefit all citizens of the United States and to assist with a treatment modality that is effective for COVID exposed and COVID sick patients of all ages. And this was paid for by the taxpayers. It's supposed to be accessible to all of us. As a result of this, and including even the US government spies listening in on doctor-patient discussions and consults, which is even more intrusive and more a violation of medical freedom and patient privacy, it is increasing medical tyranny. Truth for Health Foundation stands against all forms of tyranny, in particular, medical tyranny. And so Dr. Mangat and I, as president of Truth for Health Foundation, have launched a new program, which Dr. Mangat creatively developed in the Washington, D.C. area to serve Black churches at first, and it's now branching out. Dr. Mangat is leading the Truth for Health Foundation initiative to open monoclonal antibody infusion centers in churches, synagogues, mosques, any community of faith, and other community groups. Truth for Health Foundation is a Christian organization, and we serve people of all faiths and people who have no faith affiliation. Our role is to help get medical treatment options and medical information to help you make your decisions. Dr. Mangat, thank you for your bold leadership on this fight against medical tyranny. Tell us about your thoughts on all of this.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. First of all, it's always a privilege to come here and to serve the people. It's a sad day. We have a federal government who are listening to doctors' conversations, their private conversations with their patients. It's a sad day when the federal government wants to spy on successful programs. I mean, we just had a successful outcome on a 91-year-old who had monoclonal antibodies. And it's, you know, we should be proud that we can serve the people, we can pull them through this crisis. So I think I want to focus on is, you know, where we are. And, you know, we've got to be honest and realistic. We are filling to the brim. The hospitals, whether it's a red state or blue state, they are becoming increasingly full. And we got to remember, we are one nation under God, and we're indivisible. E pluribus unum, from many come one. And we are the most successful nation on the planet in innovation. We've innovated these monoclonal antibodies. We've innovated early treatment. We have saved lives. We've treated pregnant women. We've treated the elderly, 91-year-olds. And most important of all, we've saved the lives of our precious first responders who put their lives at risk to come and help us. In Maryland, I want to thank the Black churches. They've opened their doors, and in these places of worship have created infusion centers. People can go and get an infusion and get better and walk out feeling better. They only too well know the pain of the Tuskegee Airmen and the experimentation on them. As a director of this new program for Truth for Health, I want to pledge to you our support. We will walk down the corridors of power in your respective governor's office and help obtain these monoclonal antibodies. Unfortunately, the federal government has walked away. They've rationed and they've abdicated their civic responsibility. This was designed as a federal program, free to all, irrespective of color, creed, or insurance. And that's how this program has run since November of last year. And it's saved many, many lives. And unfortunately, they chose not to tell anybody about it, which is even worse. as a physician, I will walk through this ring of fire with you. All I ask is to be brave in battle and overcome all the impediments. We'll walk together to overcome. Truth always prevails. Let's start being Americans again. Not Christians, not Jews, not Muslims, not Sikhs, not Hindus, not red states, not blue states. Let's start being the United States and leading the world in this charge forward. We are your voice on medical freedom for the treatment, and we can give you health and inspire hope again. So let's work all together in this program and ensure that everybody gets access to monoclonal antibodies. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gut. I truly am inspired by your leadership and bringing this creative idea to our foundation for us to help more people. I encourage all of our listeners, join our crusade, join our foundation, army of voiceless who are silent no more. We are the people's foundation. Thank you for being with us today. We realize that this has been difficult and heartbreaking information, but we feel compelled to bring the truth to the American public and to help you understand that early treatment for COVID is available. There is hope, there is help, and you do not need to be a victim of medical tyranny and fear. Medical freedom is the core freedom to save our lives. We have shined a light on the abuses taking place at hospitals, schools, businesses, and health systems across the country. We call on more whistleblower doctors, nurses, attorneys, patient advocates, patients, parents, anyone who has information about the abuse of patient rights, the abuse of patients, the denial of care, pharmacists who are restricting medications, physicians who are refusing to treat COVID. Let us know. Let us hear your stories. We are exposing these abuses and we are taking action to defend against them. We need more people of courage to speak out and stand up for freedom of all aspects of our lives, most especially our access to medical care of our choice and medical care that we decide not is forced upon us by an out-of-control government. Sign up at truthforhealth.org. Support our efforts to fight medical tyranny in all its forms. Join our crusade of the voiceless. We are silent no more. Speak out, get loud, and let's be heard across America. Heavenly Father, thank you for this time to share your truth and the medical truth with people of courage leading the fight to protect your precious gift of life. We ask for your protection on all who have spoken out. We ask for your guidance and wisdom for families seeking help for their loved ones. And we ask.
This is John Henry Weston for.